Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends to doctors in women's health.
When did your interest in contemporary OBGYN begin?
Oh, heavens. So I think all of us have been contemporary OBGYN readers. Really, mine certainly began shortly after I started practice. And I don't actually know how long I've been on the board. I don't remember. But I have always been struck with, the important things, I think, for contemporary OBGYN. It's sort of my go-to for easily accessible content that I find incredibly practical and somehow manages to always be relevant to a patient that I've seen in the office this week. And it's wonderful to be part of that alchemy. I'm not sure how the contemporary OBGYN always seems to be prescient about what's the newest thing coming down the pike, or I think really something that we as providers really need to know about or want to know about. And so it's absolutely a pleasure and an honor to be part of this machinery and this process that I think really puts information, practical information, into the hands of practicing OBGYN providers around the country.
Absolutely. We're happy to have you. What led you to become a gynecologic oncologist?
My interest in GYN oncology really dated back, I think was very much set in motion by some rotations that I did in medical school. And then ultimately in residency, it was just, this marriage of the fantastic surgery, the ability to connect a patient's symptoms and discomfort with the ability to sort of look inside, do an operation, sometimes elegant, sometimes very brute force, but nonetheless to be able to sort of solve a problem, and then the longitudinal relationship for me, being able to continue to be part of that woman and her whole family's care, really from diagnosis until actual, whatever the fate of her GYN malignancy was, including giving chemotherapy, getting to know the family members. For me, this was incredibly compelling. So I think it was really the love of the problem solving and the why does it work that way, combined with that continuity of care, which I think is just part of what draws all of us to OBGYN at the very beginning. So I still feel it's a tremendous privilege to kind of accompany women and their families along this journey. And we go together.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you previously served as co-chair of the Physician Wellness Task Force. Have you implemented any wellness-related programs or practices at your department?
So a work in progress would be probably the most honest answer. And I think many of us have engaged in a combination of either homespun remedies, which were really tested, let's be honest, during COVID. And the curveball that this threw us all in leadership, but in the trenches, as to how do we do this? So I think that we were quite fortunate where I practice here. We were able to largely continue to interact with one another. And for me, it was really, Lindsay, a reminder that part of, I think, the burnout equation and the sort of standard, gold standard definition that we use to define burnout really doesn't completely capture the isolation, because I think it was the isolation that I now see as I chat with colleagues around the country, the isolation from each other, the isolation from our patients and their families. I think this took a tremendous toll. So we were quite fortunate in that we were able to preserve that component. And I think this was, I wish I could say that this was my great leadership insight. It was to some extent what the people needed. And I think my role in leadership was just to try to keep it as safe as possible and something that people felt was sanctioned. In other words, that it was good and healthy, and we tried to encourage it obviously abiding by all of the provisions that we needed to. I think beyond that, what I've really invested in now is sort of looking at, as many chairs have done recently, some feedback, official feedback from the departments. Many of us have been using the Press-Ganey engagement score as a proxy for the larger measure, I think, of burnout. And whether you're using a homegrown assay of burnout or you're relying upon the Press-Ganey scores to measure your workforce engagement, the results are very clear. Folks are really tired. So we have started a couple of interventions, the first of which is we've actually moved back to trying to have meetings in person, because I do think that that has, as I've alluded to, really given people the sense of being with others, sharing success strategies and failures, but just interacting with one another, number one. Number two, we have also, I've baked into our grand rounds a kind of a faculty development content. And this was at the request, I think, of many of my faculty members who really felt that they wanted development, but also some wellness strategies. So we've just baked that into grand rounds. Like many other folks, I think in leadership, Lindsay, I was regularly communicating with my faculty during COVID, during the height of things, oftentimes on a sort of a weekly kind of State of the Union address. And I was combing through what were the available sort of exercise apps and wellness promoting apps. And I would regularly include links to all of these things, and they're waiving their membership fee. I tried several myself. But I think when all is said and done, one really has to bake this into the content at work, how we treat each other and what we value. So the apps were fun, but I think it actually has to be part of the fabric of what do we do every single day when we interact with one another. So those are some of the strategies that we've used for our faculty. I will also say, just on a fun note, we have a wonderful committee called the Social Action Committee in my department, headed up by a sort of a motley crew of people. And honestly, one of the best antidotes for the isolation and burnout is being able to kind of share together time over these great potlucks that we have. I recognize not everyone in the country can go back to doing these, but we had our first potluck last week. And it's just so much fun to see people and interact again and sort of all march through sort of the line. But it does promote a tremendous sense of being part of a team and feeling valued. So I'm a big proponent of the Potluck Social Action Committee.
That's amazing.
Bring your crock pots. All are welcome.
Yep. Love it. So that's pretty, that covers the wellness section. That's great. I'm glad you guys are bringing stuff back and getting together again.
Well, I think everybody is really clamoring for that, because that's how we usually thrive and grow. And as I say, feel part of a team. And I think that is clearly one of the elements of burnout is you feel alone, you feel that no one cares, and you do not feel like anything motivates you anymore, and you're not as effective. And I think that the answer with healthcare delivery, no matter where, how things sort of evolve, and this is perhaps a good segue into the politics component of the questions, but the answer, I think, to healthcare delivery is it has to be team-based care. The literature clearly shows no one is an island. No one individual can do the myriads of tasks that we have to do that now involve patient care, electronic medical record, following up on all of the results and consults and communication that patients desperately need. And the team is the way to do that. And it's the team that actually has to be at the core, I think, of how we function and what we value and how we contribute.
Absolutely. So for our readers, can you just give a brief background on the abortion restrictions in New Hampshire? And if there are any updates, just sort of where that is.
Sure. So the legislation that gained quite a bit of attention here in New Hampshire was a law around the prohibition of performing abortions after 24 weeks. And I will say an important companion was mandating that an ultrasound be performed at the time of, as part of the care for that procedure. This obviously met a lot of, was sort of very conflict ridden because we hate, I think it's important as providers of women's healthcare for us to see any sort of intrusion into the domain of the relationship between a provider and their patient around options. We hate to see politicians intrude into that realm. And I think also set some incredibly dangerous precedent that it's now politicians who are actually prescribing healthcare, right? So, you know, the obvious question, well, where is their medical license? What in the world would make a politician qualified to mandate a certain test in the provision as we provide care for our patients? Neighboring states in where I live in northern New England do not have such provisions in place. So this was also a bit of a departure in that this was the first sort of chink in the armor, if you will, trying to erode some of the of access for women. There certainly are other states in the union where this legislation and even more restrictive legislation exists, but this really was the sort of first shot across the bow here in northern New England. This ended up being tacked on, as I'm beginning to learn, in the very complex policy, political battlefield. This was tacked on to a finance budget law that the governor had made pretty clear he was going to pass because he was under tremendous pressure to do so. So fairly quickly, I was involved in an attempt to halt this process. So fast forward, we were not successful, and the law did pass and will go into effect on the 1st of January, 2022, much to my disappointment. So we're not done with this. We are going to continue to organize because there is obvious concerns. What happens if a patient presents to my birthing pavilion or in need of care, who would otherwise want to pursue a termination of her pregnancy after 24 weeks. And I think that the readership and audience is well familiar with the fact that there are some conditions which wouldn't even be diagnosed that are lethal to the fetus that would not even be disclosed until after 24 weeks. And one can certainly imagine, Lindsay, if there is access to care that is in any way limited, which of course exists around the country, but certainly in rural areas like which I serve, it could come to pass that a condition that was lethal to the fetus or was going to really cause significant quality of life and functional compromise wouldn't even be disclosed after 24 weeks. That patient has no choice here in the state of New Hampshire except to proceed with the pregnancy. The proviso is that if the mother's life is in peril, then she can have the termination. So moving forward, this is something that we will continue to fight, and we've got some strategies in place. But I think my concluding important points that I would make about this that I have certainly learned are, number one, as OBGYNs, we have to be very clear, in my opinion, about our role as advocates for women's healthcare and for women. If we don't do this work, I don't know who's going to. And this was very important to me in my role as a chair, that I needed to be able to speak up and speak sort of my truth and experience, because I think we do carry such tremendous weight as physicians and providers for women. And when I sat on these in many Senate Judiciary Committee meetings, I was really delighted to see the weight of our voice that was accorded appropriately. And that when you have a number of different physicians and providers banding together, people listen and they pay attention. I think the second important point is we cannot be in any way complacent. This is the beginning of a war and a concerted effort on the part of many politicians to drive outside of their lane and feel entitled and capable in restricting how we care for our patients. And again, I would say there is no room for a politician in the exam room. That's not their job. That's not how they're trained. That is our role and ours alone.
Absolutely. And how can some of our audience join you in that fight or help support you?
Yeah. Yeah. So my own journey, I mean, I can share with you mine. Honestly, this was my naivete and my maiden voyage in how does one do this? So the first thing that I learned here very quickly is that your medical center obviously has someone in charge of, or your hospital will clearly have someone in charge of sort of PR and or someone who may be, who is tasked with having their finger on the pulse of governmental relations. I am incredibly fortunate at Dartmouth-Hitchcock because we are the academic medical center in this state, and we do not have a very large population. We have two designated individuals, one locally, one nationally, who are charged with keeping their finger on the pulse and the sort of bi-directional communication that is necessary to make sure that everything that flies in the airspace of medicine, and specifically OBGYN, that there's a clear ability to communicate with us as the physicians. And similarly, things that we feel touch our lives that we want to advocate for or speak up about to government. Beyond that, I made a very early sort of connected with some of the other politically active individuals in my department, including our representatives, our local and sort of district representatives to ACOG, who obviously are a wonderful go-to resource because these are the waters in which these folks swim. And oftentimes they have got sort of a heads up about what to expect, looking at what's going on in the national landscape in one district versus another. And then finally, I was very fortunate and able to reach out to the leadership of the hospital and discuss with them, this is our experience, this is what we see, and this is why this is so important. And I was met with tremendous support to, again, speak my truth and represent our department and really advocate for women. So I think all of those are resources. And then, of course, in this particular instance, I have to say our local Planned Parenthood was also a wonderful resource for me. And I got involved pretty quickly with their government relations arm and was able to sort of get that kind of larger contextual view about what's going on in the United States. So I think for all of those reasons, again, I just really want to emphasize and encourage our readership. Stand up. You are speaking for your patients. And if not you, who is going to do this? Because we are really in a very privileged position to be able to advocate on the behalf of our patients.
Absolutely. It's so important. Are you involved in any research projects or annual meetings coming up?
So annual meetings coming up, of course, continues to be a work in progress. But I would say my research interests have evolved as I've moved to this part of the country. And one of the things that's been incredibly exciting, which I'm happy to talk about, is the notion of rural healthcare delivery and specifically rural poor. And I think this is a topic that exists, obviously, it touches every single state in the United States of America. But I think we have to recognize that much of the research that has been done historically, not surprisingly, has come out of large urban centers, which doesn't necessarily embrace the entire population in America.
Right.
And so we've really, I think, on the heels of so much of the innovation that we've seen out of necessity with telemedicine, and how can we sort of meet the patients where they are and respond to the challenges, not only of the distance that people have to travel, but in my part of the world, the geography and the weather, and really, how can we reimagine what does optimal rural healthcare delivery look like? So for example, in the context of opioid addiction and substance use disorders, you know, these were patients, especially pregnant women who really suffered with COVID. The number one cause of maternal mortality here in Northern New England for Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire is actually is overdose of within sort of the first 6 to 8 weeks postpartum. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, which is pretty chilling and not necessarily, and I'm sure applies to many portions of the United States, but was not really something that I was aware of until I got here. And so we've embarked upon some research and a small grant to really try to look at how can we sort of connect the dots of so many wonderful community-based organizations who are working in their own individual sort of silos to care for women. And how can we link that all up with the ultimate goal, of course, of reducing neonatal, you know, the consequences for neonates born as a result of substance use disorders, both to support these patients during their pregnancy, but then to also really consider and support the whole family once the infant is born, in hopes of promoting retention in the medical healthcare system, recognizing that pregnancy is an incredibly valuable time in which we can have this sort of establish a conversation and trusting relationship with our patients. We've also looked at how can we innovate in healthcare delivery in the world of cancer and specifically managing symptoms of patients postoperatively. So what do we really need to be connecting with patients? How can we use all available technologies, including apps on their smartphone, to really wrap our arms around how are patients doing? Do they have access to resources to help manage their symptoms postoperatively? And do we have a good way to really know when we have to pull the fire alarm and get those patients in a timely fashion? So this is some of the research that I'm sort of trying to do as we work out, I think all of us, how do we emerge from the telemedicine sort of and televideo experience that we've had into a durable product that may actually answer and solve a lot of our patients' healthcare needs that still provides value. Because ultimately, again, I think what we've had to learn is we need to innovate in how we provide patient care and the expectation that everyone's going to get in the car and come to the big the big house, to the medical center, is really not, I think, how is not the future of medicine.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PAP Talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.